one of the interesting people to watch on Iraq right now, even though he isn't making U.S. policy there, is Senator Rand Paul. As you know, he's a serious Republican presidential contender for 2016. And like his father, Ron Paul, his foreign policy is very libertarian, read that isolationist, compared to most Republicans or Democrats. Here is Paul on CNN's State of the Union on Sunday in conversation with CNN's Candy Crowley about what to do next in Iraq.
We are still arming the radical Islamic rebels in Syria. So the homeland, they're going back and forth across the border. They go back into Syria, and that is a homeland that we are helping to defend
for them. How do you stop that?
Well, let's not be involved in the Syrian civil war, and let's not be involved in the Iraq civil war.
I think that out altogether.
Well, no, what I would say is that Maliki is an ally. Although here's the thing is, they think they're going to create stability by pushing Maliki out in the middle of a war. So we push him out, and then we have another power vacuum and nobody leading the country at all. What I would say is, and my prediction is, that Maliki will stand up and the Shiites will stand up, that ISIS will not be able to take Baghdad. There will be a civil war over there, but there'll be a civil war with feckless people on one side that aren't necessarily great allies of ours, who are allies of Iran, and on the other side, allies of Al-Qaeda. You have to ask yourself, are you willing to send your son? Am I willing to send my son to retake back a city, Mosul, that they weren't willing to defend themselves? I'm not willing to send my son into that mess.
Kentucky Senator Rand Paul on CNN on Sunday, quite the opposite of the kind of thing that people like Dick Cheney is saying, also John McCain.
This has turned into one of the most serious threats to American security in recent history. It means that we are now facing an existential threat to the security of the United States of America.
And remember that term, existential threat to the security of the United States of America. We'll come back to it. But let's start there and bring in Yochi Driesen, deputy editor for news at Foreign Policy Magazine in Washington. We'll talk about the interesting place of Rand Paul and today's developments with John Kerry in Baghdad. Hi, Yochi. Welcome to WNYC.
Hi, Brian. Good morning.
How alone is Rand Paul among Republican presidential hopefuls in holding positions like the ones we just heard?
You know, I think it's a fascinating question. You know, for the most part, right now, he's a bit by himself. But I think in some ways the more interesting question is, where is he relative to the rest of the country? And that's where it gets a little bit interesting and a little bit trickier. You know, you have the leadership of the Republican Party more in the John McCain camp, not quite in the let's send in the troops in large numbers, but in the let's hammer them with more airstrikes, let's hammer them with more drone strikes. But when you look at the polling on where the country isn't there. And it's a weird dichotomy because the country, there's a poll out from the New York Times that details this a bit. On the one hand, they don't approve of the way President Obama is handling Iraq. On the other hand, they do approve of the idea of what he's actually doing, of sending military advisors and of using drone strikes. So Rand Paul may not be speaking for the Republican Party, but he's arguably speaking for the country as a whole.
You read that New York Times poll exactly the way I did today. And I'd go even one step further that the majority in that poll seemed to say no to any slippery slope to major reinvolvement in Iraq, which is unlike McCain's call to be more interventionist.
Exactly. I mean, McCain's been calling for intervention, a more interventionist, more militaristic policy in Syria for now going on 3 years, in Iraq since this began 3 or 4 months ago. And you can understand where he's coming from. He's been hawkish on this from the beginning. If anything, he thought the surge that took place under President Bush didn't go far enough. But he's increasingly isolated. I mean, this is not where his party is, and it's most certainly not where the country is. And that's, I think, the line the White House is trying to tread. There's the policy question of, is this president willing to do anything that can, as you put it, I think very accurately, have a slippery slope to a longer quagmire or a longer war? On the other hand, if you believe that's the thing you should do, can you do it if the country's not with you? And right now the country isn't.
So let's go back to Rand Paul 2016. To many Republican primary voters, Ron Paul's presidential primary debates made him a hero on domestic policy. But when he opened his mouth on foreign policy, even if the country tends to agree in the ways that you were just laying out with respect to today's situation, back in 2013, for the 2012 race, Ron Paul looked to many conservatives like a wacko. Or worse, a liberal Democrat, blame America, peacenik. So this is from a December 2013 primary debate where Ron Paul gets into it with Michelle Bachmann.
I would say that the greatest danger is overreacting. There is no evidence that they have it. We ought to really sit back and think and not jump the gun and believe that we are going to be attacked. That's how we got into that useless war in Iraq and lost so much.
With all due respect to Ron Paul, I think I have never heard a more dangerous answer for American security than the one that we just heard from Ron Paul. And I'll tell you the reason why. And the reason why I would say that is because we know without a shadow of a doubt that Iran will take a nuclear weapon. They will use it to wipe our ally Israel off the face of the map, and they've stated they will use it against the United States of America.
What is the whole world about the drone being in Iran? And we're begging and pleading, and how are we going to start a war to get this drone back? Why were we flying a drone over Iran? Why do we have to bomb so many countries? Why are we in, have 900 bases, 130 countries, and we're totally bankrupt? How are you going to rebuild the military when we have no money? How are we going to take care of the people?
All right. I think Ron Paul got the bigger cheer there from, and to be clear about the date, that was December 2011 in the 2012 presidential primary cycle. And Yoki from Foreign Policy Magazine, I think Rand Paul is trying to walk a less pure line to maintain viability to actually win a presidential election, or at least the Republican nomination. Not to just be a gadfly like his father comes off there. But I'm not sure I heard much of a real policy difference in that CNN interview, did you?
No, I didn't. And it's always interesting when there's a given specific word that people are desperate to avoid, even if it's accurate. So for a long time, you had Democrats desperate to avoid being called liberal. A liberal term was like the slur that no Democrat wanted to be associated with. So now they've adopted the term progressive. And even liberals come back a little bit. With Rand Paul, you can tell the word he does not want to be described with is isolationist. He is desperate for that not to be the way that he's described, I think precisely because of what you mentioned, that that's not, that word is not where the Republican Party is. But the polling suggests even on the Republican Party, there's movement to where he is. And one of the things you hear smart analysts say who focus solely on politics is that Rand Paul would have a hard time getting from the primary, but that a lot of his positions, legalizing marijuana, keeping the government basically out of the business of trying to ban abortion or trying to fight the legalization of gay marriage, that's the way you have to win an election, that you can get younger voters who have turned against the Republican Party overwhelmingly. You could bring them back if this is where you are policy-wise.
Wait, let me challenge one thing you just said or question. Is he pro-choice on abortion? Because the traditional libertarian thinking on abortion is just what you said. Keep the government out of people's lives. Keep the government out of women's bodies, just as they want to keep the government off the backs of businesses, et cetera. But there's a more contemporary, politically strategic libertarian position which says, well, the right of the fetus as a human being is still so fundamental that you can be a libertarian and still be anti-choice. Doesn't Rand Paul lean that way a little bit?
He does, and I think you've nailed it exactly on the head and the nuance between the two. And I think that when he's trying to get through a Republican primary, he'll stress the point you just made, that sure, I'm libertarian, but I'm not pro-choice. I am pro-fetus. I am pro-life. But the truth of it is that nuance will get lost on a lot of people. And I think what a lot of not Republican primary voters but actual voters will hear is, here's a Republican who isn't obsessed about abortion. He may be against it. He may not like it. Mm. But this won't be a culture war issue for him.
Like Pope Francis. That's like Pope Francis, funny enough. So on foreign policy, and listeners, if you want to call up on anything pertaining to Iraq for Yoki Driesen from Foreign Policy Magazine, or anything pertaining to Rand Paul and his presidential hopefuls, and particularly with respect to his libertarian foreign policy and that the question of whether he can be a serious hopeful in the context of those. We're talking about this intersection now of Iraq at the moment and Rand Paul. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Since you're at Foreign Policy Magazine and probably look at this stuff more closely than I do, are there nuances that you can discern, nuance differences between Rand Paul's position and his father, Ron Paul's position? Because Ron Paul was so isolationist, I'll just use that word, is Rand Paul for certain kinds of intervention, short of being John McCain, short of being Dick Cheney, that he will be able to call up and say, look, I am for this, I am for that, I'm just not for the big stuff?
I think where you see the major difference is that with Ron Paul, it was not only what would you do in the future, it's what will you do in the present, or even what would you do differently in the past. In the clip he played, it was him talking about why do we have all these bases around the world. So for him, the question wasn't from these bases should we mount drone attacks, from these bases should we mount airstrikes. It was the existence of those bases, full stop. Plus the we shouldn't do drone strikes, plus we shouldn't do airstrikes, plus we shouldn't deploy troops. With Rand Paul, he doesn't quite go that far. So he makes the argument, as in the clip you played, of we shouldn't get involved in the Syrian civil war, we shouldn't get involved in the Iraq civil war, we shouldn't go back to a George H.W. Bush, we shouldn't be the world's policeman. But he also doesn't go as far as his father does in saying, let's cut the defense budget, let's close bases around the world, let's pull a lot of troops back from around the world. And I think that's a difference he'll try to stress when he tries to say, I'm not my father, I could be a commander-in-chief, I'm not someone who will just pull back in every possible respect.
Interesting. And I wonder what you think this clip tells us about the Republican rank and file's feelings about Iraq. This is Dick Cheney, who's been in a little bit of a public back and forth with Rand Paul on their competing positions. I'm not sure that they've been mentioning each other by name, but that's how it's been analyzed. And, of course, it's arguably Cheney's war as much as anyone's. This is Cheney being questioned by Fox News Channel anchor Megyn Kelly the other day about his current and enduring hawkishness.
Not only did the combat forces leave, but all of the other forces left as well. Our generals had recommended a level of 20,000 to stay behind. The White House said no and cut it ultimately to 3,000, and frankly, that was inadequate to do the job. No agreement was ever reached. But the result was an Iraqi military that was unable to stand up to the terrorists when the ISIS came in from Syria a few days ago.
In your op-ed, you write as follows: rarely has a U.S. president been so wrong about so much at the expense of so many. But time and time again, history has proven that you got it wrong as well in Iraq, sir. You said there was no doubt Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. You said we would be greeted as liberators. You said the Iraq insurgency was in the last throes back in 2005. And you said that after our intervention, extremists would have to, quote, rethink their strategy of jihad. Now, with almost $1 trillion spent there, with 4,500 American lives lost there, what do you say to those who say you were so wrong about so much at the expense of so many?
No, I just fundamentally disagree, Megan. You've got to go back and look at the track record. We inherited a situation where there was no doubt in anybody's mind about the extent of Saddam's involvement in weapons of mass destruction.
So Dick Cheney with Megyn Kelly on Fox News Channel the other day. I wish, Yochi, that there was a live audience in that room when he accidentally called her Reagan. That was pretty funny.
Yeah.
But wow, does Megyn Kelly speak for Fox News Nation, you know, Republican primary voter nation there, and sort of fundamentally discrediting Dick Cheney in that line of questioning?
I mean, I was struck by that question, too, in part because it was the best framed, most cogent question that I've ever seen posed to him. You know, it had an edge to it, but it was also extraordinarily well informed. And I think it's a sign of where, how much the Republican Party and the audience Fox News has, how much they've shifted. It's not that there is residual, we should have stayed in Iraq longer, residual, man, it was a good decision to do it. Sure, we may have bungled the execution, but the decision to go in was correct. That's not where the party is. The party isn't where Rand Paul is, but it's certainly not where Dick Cheney is, and it's certainly not where John McCain is. And that shift is a remarkable one.
Yochi Drezin, Assistant Managing Editor for News at Foreign Policy Magazine, as we talk about Rand Paul in Iraq, the Republican primary nation on Iraq, and also just the current situation and the choices facing the United States at the moment. 212-433-WNYC and Ty in Manhattan. You're on the air. Hi, Ty.
Pretty much in terms of Rand Paul as a candidate, his candidacy has been analyzed in detail on the libertarian site Lula. Rockwell. That's lewrockwell.com. But the question for the immediate question for the guest is, in to what extent do you feel Rand Paul as a candidate can escape the neoconservative wing of the Republican Party in terms of the jingoistic military first option foreign policy, and essentially maintain his essentially Rand Paul maintaining his own foreign policy objective of essentially armed neutrality?
Well, I guess that's the question we've been asking throughout this segment. But do you want to respond to his framing of it in any different way?
Just one quick point. You know, this election has been framed up until now as Tea Party versus establishment on economic issues, on issues of debt. I live in Washington. People are still astounded by Eric Cantor losing his seat to this completely unknown Tea Party candidate. So that's the kind of frame and the division that people have focused on. But I think your caller is exactly right, that there's an equally important and perhaps going forward more important question that we've been discussing between the interventionist neocon wing and the more isolationist wing. So this election isn't simply Tea Party versus establishment. It's also neocon versus we need to stay out of this horrible quagmire.
212-433-WNYC and Frank in West Babylon. You're on WNYC. Hi, Frank.
Hey, Brian. How are you?
Okay.
I have a quick question for the guest. I remember a number of years ago, the Libertarian Party, they kind of stood for open borders, free flow of labor from one country to the other without government intervention and immigration policies and things like that. And Eric Cantor just lost his seat mainly based upon his, you know, stance on, you know, loosening some type of immigration controls, perhaps. I'm just curious as to where the guest feels the Tea Party is today with this immigration and Rand Paul and Libertarians who are more for an open border type of approach.
That's an interesting question. And, of course, there's been a lot of back and forth on how much Cantor's immigration stance and the way he was trying to nuance it on immigration actually had to do with his defeat. But what about the Libertarians and the classic Libertarian position of open borders, which is their position? It's that the market will out and labor and employers, you know, will find each other. And why should government set up artificial borders to block labor and employers from finding each other? And they're really open borders when you get to the pure libertarian theory. How close to that is Rand Paul?
I think Frank asked a fantastic question. And there are a couple of areas. I mean, the short answer is he's moved away from that as quickly as he possibly could to try to get closer to the Republican mainstream of we need to secure the borders. Maybe we could possibly rethink ultimately immigration policy, but first borders have to be closed, first no amnesty. So he's moved much more to the mainstream. Arguably, the only other issue where you've seen him abandon a pure libertarian philosophy more than on immigration is when he was asked probably a year ago at this point about the Civil Rights Act. And he said, sure, morally it was right, but I would not have signed it because it put the government into hiring decisions and into the flow of the marketplace. And of course, ran back from that as soon as it blew up. So I think Frank's right to identify differences between pure libertarian thought and where a politician has to go, and immigration is one of them.
We have a very interesting couple of callers waiting who want to contrast the current situation with the past, and I think they're a really interesting contrast with each other. So let's see if we can get James on the Upper West Side.
Yeah.
On. James, hang on one second because I'm going to put you on with Jim in the Bronx at the same time. Let's see if we can get you both up. Jim, you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Thank
okay,
you.
Let's see. James, you go first because you go further back in history. Hi.
Yes, I think if you look at the 20th century, the people who want to disengage from America's leadership in the world, who don't want America to be the world policeman, didn't they have their run in the 1920s and 30s? Isn't that exactly what America did after World War One? We left Europe in disgust. And we disarmed, basically, we reduced the military virtually to zero. I think it was less than half of 1% of GDP in the military spending. We were not involved in Europe after World War One the way we were after World War Two. We were not the world's policemen. And it seems to me that the 1920s and the 1930s didn't turn out so good. The middle of the 20th century, we had the great World War Two.
But, which, Jim, and so I'll leave that there. The thought is clear. And, Jim, you want to cite something from a little bit more recent in history, but also as a lesson?
Yeah,
my recollection of the run-up to the war in Iraq in 2003 was that the neocons pushing this wanted to, among other things, get America over the so-called Vietnam syndrome, so the fear of engagement after the American defeat there. And going back to these poll numbers you gave at the beginning of the discussion, if anything, that syndrome is far more reinforced, with most Americans wanting to wash their hands of the whole thing and walk away. So from that point of view, has anyone addressed this, of how this neocon philosophy has completely backfired from what these people wanted to accomplish?
Really interesting. So let's take both of these. James, do you not feel that the United States ramped up sufficiently and successfully to win World War II after demilitarizing in the 20s when World War I was over?
Well, of course we did. In the late 30s, we rearmed. Well, actually, not until 1940 did we start to rearm. And we led the world, against the Nazi fascist alliance. And then we led the world to prevent the communist totalitarian takeover. And we had a relative period of peace and prosperity for at least 50, 60 years. Now, of course, we made some terrible mistakes. I mean, Vietnam was a well-intentioned effort to contain the communist threat, but it was a misinterpretation of what was going on in Vietnam at that time. So we made a big blunder there. And Iraq may, you know, historians may look back on Iraq and say, well, you know, this guy Saddam was someone that the world really wanted to be rid of, but maybe we bungled that as well. But aside from the bunglings, you have to put all of the positives of American leadership as the policeman of the world, and there is no other candidate to be the policeman of the world.
Jim, did you want to say something else about that?
Only that I don't share any of those interpretations of history, but that's another point. What I did want to say about Iraq is that I was strongly opposed to this war in 2003, but I'm actually appalled that now that Americans have blown the country up, they simply want to walk away and forget about it. I think that's morally reprehensible of the general public. I think so. This should be talked about as well.
Interesting. James and Jim, I thank you both very much for chiming in. Yeah, that Yoki Driesen from Foreign Policy Magazine was Colin Powell's Pottery Barn principle, right? If we go into Iraq, he said back at the time, you broke it, you bought it. Well, we broke it, and now America is debating whether we want to go in and whether it's in our national interest to go in again. Then Jim raises whatever moral responsibility we have to the Iraqi people still.
Right, and I think the Colin Powell analogy, arguably both in Afghanistan and Iraq, the counterpoint would be we did buy it, but how long do we have to hold on to it to? You know, not to take the metaphor too far, but if you buy something and you get tired of it and you decide to throw it away, can you do so?
Which comes back to Rand Paul saying, if the people of Mosul aren't willing to stand and fight for Mosul, then why are we going to put our boys' blood there?
Exactly. I mean, I lived in Iraq for about 3 years, and I lived in Afghanistan for about a year. And the joke in both countries, particularly in Afghanistan, was we have managed to find the only Afghans who don't like to fight. And unfortunately, what we're seeing in Iraq is we appear to have found the only Iraqis who don't like to fight. There are Shiite militias in the south perfectly willing to fight. There are the Peshmerga from the Kurds in the north perfectly willing to fight. Then you have the Iraqi army not only flee, but as you know, literally leave behind their uniforms and their weapons and their money as they go, which is extraordinary. And I think you can understand why for a lot of the country looking at these images of uniforms on the road as people who had run away saying, we lost 5,000 people, we lost $1 trillion. Why are we still there? I don't think Rand Paul is remotely the minority on that question.
And Jim raises the question of whether the Vietnam syndrome wasn't reinforced over the last 10, 11 years inadvertently by the neocons bungling Iraq so badly, because here we are again, like Vietnam, looking both imperialist and ineffective.
Right. And I think the return of the Vietnam scenario is interesting for another reason, which is you're beginning to hear rumblings, especially among military people on military blogs, just if you walk in the Pentagon saying, we had this thing won, and Obama lost it. And I don't think it's a fair critique. It's a lot more nuanced than that. But if we think back to what the post-Vietnam debate has been for decades, it has basically been, if Lyndon Johnson hadn't micromanaged this war, we, the military, eventually would have won it. And
right.
You might see a return to that now.
So is the blame for the failure? I mean, do you have an opinion about this, that you know, one of the ironies of the new U.S. troop deployment to Iraq is that the 300 American special forces being sent as advisors won't have immunity from local prosecution if they do anything there that someone thinks is a crime. And it was precisely that lack of immunity, which U.S. forces are generally granted everywhere, that led the U.S. under Obama to decide to leave no troops there after the pullout in 2011. So number one, has Kerry or anyone been asked why they would send troops now with no immunity if that was the deal breaker 3 years ago? And how much do you buy the claim that if only Obama had left 5,000 non-combat advisor troops in Iraq, that's the figure that usually gets cited, Cheney and Eclipse at 20,000, but I think John McCain says 5,000 non-combat advisor troops in Iraq after 2011, that there would be no ISIS surge today?
So I think on the first one, it is a difficult question. My sense from having lived there was when you had 20,000 or 10,000 or 5,000 troops who were out in the streets of Baghdad, out in the streets of Mosul, driving vehicles that would knock Iraqi cars off the road, conducting raids that might kick down the door to an Iraqi house and shoot the wrong person, there you can understand why needing immunity was a big deal. Here we have 300 troops who will almost certainly be based either in the green zone or maximally in some of the Iraqi ministries outside the green zone, perhaps at a military base in Basra or in Mosul, but who will not be driving, who will not be kicking down doors, who will not be conducting raids, that the need for immunity is not remotely as high as it was in the past. So I think just the White House has a fair point in saying this isn't quite the same as it was, mm-hmm. but their line right now is, unless they have it, we're not going. So, you know, they haven't fully backed away from what they had said in the past. To your point about whether the 5,000 would have made a difference, I think the argument what you're hearing now is not so much they would have somehow miraculously prevented a cowardly Iraqi army from running away, but it's more it might have given us more leverage over Maliki. It might have made sure that he wouldn't have immediately started trying to arrest the Sunni vice president of the country, immediately trying to arrest Sunni members of parliament, immediately trying to arrest or kill journalists. So not so much that the military would have been better, but that the government would have been better, and that because the government was less sectarian and was less harsh on the Sunnis, when ISIS came over the border, the Sunnis in the north wouldn't have immediately said, yeah, these guys are extreme, but they're better than Maliki.
So before you go, here's a clip of Kerry in Baghdad in the last day. And remember at the beginning of the segment, I said to keep in mind, everybody, the John McCain claim that ISIS in Iraq is an existential threat to the United States. Listen to how Kerry uses that same phrase, but differently in Iraq.
It is a moment of decision for Iraq's leaders. And it's a moment of great urgency. Iraq faces an existential threat, and Iraq's leaders have to meet that threat with the incredible urgency that it demands. The very future of Iraq depends on choices that will be made in the next days and weeks. And the future of Iraq depends primarily on the ability of Iraq's leaders to come together and take a stand united against ISIL.
So, Yoki Driesen from Foreign Policy magazine, did you find it a subtle pushback to John McCain to call ISIS an existential threat, still using that phrase existential threat to Iraq rather than, say, to the United States? Or is he basically saying the same thing?
No, I noticed that, too. And I think that with ISIS and ISIL, depending on the acronym you want to use, it's somewhat aspirational. So the question isn't, can they right now today hit the United States?
And let's remind people of the acronym. The acronym ISIS, it's Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, right?
Right, or Islamic State of Iraq and al-Sham, depending on how you want to do it. The other one is Iraqi State of Iraq and the Levant, or other kind of variants of it.
That's the L. It's the same area.
Right, exactly. And for John McCain, what he's arguing basically is now or in the very near future, this will be a base from which attacks could be launched into the United States. What Kerry is arguing isn't he isn't making the opposite point, but he's making the point that right now, at this exact moment, the threat is not to us. At this exact moment, the threat is to the government in Baghdad, to the territorial integrity of Iraq. And I don't think that either side, either party would argue that point.
And on they go at a very complicated moment. We'll see what Secretary of State Kerry comes out with, if anything, from his visit to Baghdad and what happens next on these many fronts. We thank for a very interesting analysis, Yoki Driesen, Managing Editor for News at Foreign Policy Magazine. Yoki, thanks a lot.
My pleasure, Brian.
And thanks to all of you for your participation.